President Washington say to his troops as they cross the Delaware? I'm sure you're well aware.
What they say?
We can do it. We can do it. We can do it, me and you. We can do it. We can do it. We can make our dreams come true. Everything you've ever wanted.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. Joining us now is Dean Baker, who is co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. His latest e-book is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dean Baker.
Thanks for having me on.
And I take it the theme of your new e-book, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, is essentially that progressives have accepted the conservatives' framing of political debates and the framing that conservatives like the market while liberals like the government puts liberals in a position of seeming to want to tax the winners to help the losers.
Exactly. So the implication is that somehow, you know, we just had this distribution of income, you know, we rolled the die and, you know, it turned out Bill Gates and Pete Peterson, these people came out on top, and then, you know, other people didn't do very well. And now we're out there saying, well, we don't really like that, so we want to tax the winners and hand it to the losers. And, you know, I don't mind saying, I don't like that. I don't like that distribution of income. But the key point is that it doesn't matter what I like or don't like. It wasn't just that we rolled the dice. They rigged the deck. And we're ignoring the fact that they rigged the deck. So if we just play the game, if we just have our political debates from the standpoint that everything was fair, but we just don't like the way, you know, the way the market outcomes turned out, we put ourselves at an enormous disadvantage, both politically and also in policy terms.
So, in other words, we got to get over this ridiculous debate over President Clinton's tax increase and President Bush's reversal with his massive tax cuts. It's not about tax cuts for the rich. It's a systemic problem that goes back to Reagan.
Exactly. And, you know, it's, I'd love to, you know, the rich can pay more in taxes. I mean, that's, you know, so I'm not disputing that. I don't think the tax cuts on the rich aren't fair or they're onerous or this and that. I mean, we've had much, much higher tax rates on the wealthy. But the far more important issue is the upward redistribution of before tax income. So, you know, I made some comment somewhere that we're kind of, this is the kids' table at Thanksgiving dinner. We're focused on, you know, this tax rate, there's like $50 billion a year at stake in the taxes on the upper 2%, whereas we're talking about literally trillions that have been redistributed in terms of income each year from those at the middle and bottom to those in the top 10%, particularly at the top 1%. So we're kind of, you know, focused on the wrong, you know, the lesser part of the story when we just talk about taxes.
So walk us through the elements then that make up this systemic problem as opposed to the one that gets all the headlines and the attention about the tax rates of billionaires, which you point out will only bring the Treasury $50 billion a year extra as opposed to the trillions that are out there being maldistributed.
Well, there's a variety of different factors that, you know, led to this upper redistribution of income. Some of it, a big factor, was weakening unions. It's quite deliberate policy the Reagan administration put in effect, you know, after he took office, made it much more difficult to organize, made it much more difficult to strike. One of the big stories, we just passed the 30th anniversary of the PATCO strike, the air traffic controllers. And, of course, he fired the air traffic controllers. And that was something that was pretty much unprecedented, that people would actually lose their jobs for going out on strike. It was a rare employer that would literally fire their striking workers and hire replacement workers. And that became standard practice in the 80s. And that, again, was conscious design, weaken the power of unions. People think that we're looking to the government to protect workers. No, the government comes down a very heavy hand if workers engage in strikes that are in violation of the National Labor Relations Law. So what we have is a situation where employers violate labor relations law all the time. They fire workers when they're trying to organize. Absolute standard practice in the textbook of good management. Whereas if unions violate labor law, they pay heavy fines. The officers go to prison. That's what happened with the PANCO strike. The officers were actually locked up, put behind bars. So it's not a question of why the government intervene. The question is, how does the government intervene? Trade policy. We quite deliberately adopted the trade policy that put our manufacturing workers in direct competition with low-paid laborers all over the world. So our auto workers in Detroit have to compete with workers that get paid maybe a tenth as much in Mexico and China and other countries. That was absolutely conscious policy. We didn't do the same with doctors and lawyers. Those are highly paid professionals protected from foreign competition. A high dollar, an overvalued dollar, this is a conscious policy of the Clinton administration after Robert Rubin took over as Treasury Secretary. An overvalued dollar in effect subsidizing imports and putting a tariff on exports. That makes it even harder for our manufacturing workers to compete. That, in effect, puts downward pressure on the wages of manufacturing workers, and I should say more generally, the 70% of the workforce that doesn't have college degrees, to the benefit of, you know, the higher-end workers. Too big to fail banks. You know, we have J.P. Morgan, Goldman Sachs, all these very large banks that, in effect, operate with an implicit insurance policy from the government. So they can take big risks, get big profits. When they lose, taxpayers bail them out. So there's a series of ways which we could identify in which the government is coming to the aid of those at the top end of the wealth distribution, penalizing those at the middle and bottom.
And you have to add to that, of course, patent protection, right?
Patent protection is hugely important. I focus on prescription drugs just because it's such a clear-cut case, and there is a lot of money at stake. We spend roughly $300 billion a year on prescription drugs, and the incredible part of the story is they would be cheap. Drugs would be very cheap without patent protection, without a government-guaranteed monopoly. Most drugs are very cheap to produce. You can go to chain retail stores and buy most drugs for $4 or $5 a prescription. That's what they would all cost if we didn't have the government intervening, giving Pfizer, Merck, and the other big pharmaceutical companies monopolies. So here it is. We're talking about somewhere on the order of $250, $270 billion a year in extra money that gets handed to the pharmaceutical companies. That never really gets raised as an issue. Instead, we're yelling about the $50 billion in the Bush tax cuts.
So this is a kind of it's not so much a battle cry, it's a battle plan that you're laying out here.
Well, I hope to. I mean, you know, it's at least to my mind an outline of the issues that need to be raised. I'm sure there's many, many more. I mean, some I can identify that I even talk about in the book. And, you know, the issues that I do raise, I can't say I have, like, you know, how do you go from where we are today to victory. But the point is we have to at least get these issues on the table, because as it stands now, you know, the best case story, okay, let's say, let's envision that we get President Obama reelected in 2012 and he has enough support in Congress. We get the Bush tax cuts, you know, expiring at the end of 2012. So we have to talk about how you shift the debate in a very fundamental way.
And given that the Republicans now are referring to billionaires, now you've made the point that if we continue to fight more and more rounds over the Bush tax cut for the wealthy, we're going to get nowhere. We're missing the big picture. But it does seem that, you know, when you talk about framing, the conservatives are now, you know, they've been pretty clever in the way they frame things. But I'm not sure about how clever it is to refer to billionaires as job creators, which is the latest kind of Republican talking point. Do you think that Obama's strategy of trying to, which of course he lost in the debt ceiling crisis, which was manufactured by the Republicans, he tried to shame them by saying that, you know, all you cared about is tax cuts for corporate jets and not for the working man. Is that working somewhere in America? Because I just wonder at times whether people in this country truly have, you know, been bought this bill of goods that your economic destiny is tied up with the freedom of of the very wealthy not to pay taxes.
I think President Obama probably is doing pretty well on that. I mean, the polls typically show him doing a lot better than Congress in the debate over the debt ceiling. And, you know, as a practical matter, I don't think there's a lot of people that buy the argument that if we had somewhat higher taxes on the rich, you know, where you cut that off is a debating point. But, you know, if you had a higher tax on the rich, that would be very harmful. I think what is the concern that they, you know, I think they exploit it somewhat effectively. Of course, President Obama won the election, but you know, when you go back to 2008, they were running around with Joe the Plumber saying, no, he's not going to tax the rich. He's Joe the Plumber. The whole point was, he was Joe Everyman, as a guy that's not rich, quite explicitly not rich. And, you know, there's a lot of untruth to that because, of course, President Obama wasn't talking about taxing him more. But I think that's the concern. People believe that, oh, yeah, they're saying they're going to tax the rich, but they really want to tax, you know, the ordinary person. So I think that could be a winning line for the Republicans, if they can convince people that's true. I don't know to what extent they have thus far.
Well, I understand that there's a Republican proposal in the House to end the moratorium or the holiday on the payroll tax. In other words, to reinstate the payroll tax, which is a regressive tax, effectively taxing people for having a job.
Well, you know, the Democrats have made a big issue of this. I'm not sure that that's very clever because we do need that money for Social Security. So we don't need it this year. And, of course, the plan is that Social Security is going to be credited with that money regardless. So the idea is that, you know, instead of having this come from the payroll tax, you'll have it come from general revenue, which, you know, is fine if there's a consensus for that and we can keep going like that. But there isn't really. I mean, no one argued for that being an ongoing way to finance the program. So the program has historically been funded by the payroll tax. This was a departure from it in 2011, where we did have this tax holiday, a 2 percentage point reduction in the payroll tax, and made up for it with general revenue. President Obama wants to continue that in 2012. That's okay. I mean, I wouldn't necessarily say that's a bad thing, but it does raise issues about the future of the program. And if the Democrats think it's really clever to say, oh, we can't raise that, that's a tax on, you know, Joe working stiff, well, that's really not clever because we do need that money for Social Security at some point. So unless they could somehow guarantee that we're going to get that money from general revenue, and guarantees from the Democrats have not been worth very much lately, I really don't think that's a terribly clever strategy.
So as we approach the next year, the election year, it's a sort of truism, Dean Baker, that politicians hate to run in a bad economy, and that President Obama really has an albatross around his neck, as do the Democrats. And you've got people like Rick Perry, who's now the Republican frontrunner, out there talking about jobs, 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 these so-called Texas miracle. So just to accept that notion, it really is the economy stupid, as Jim Carville said, right? That people simply don't have a very sophisticated understanding about how we got into this economic mess, who's dug the hole deeper, which arguably the Republicans just did with this debt ceiling deal. That none of that washes, right? People just are sort of irrationally angry at the situation, and they strike out at whoever's in power.
Well, that's been the history, and, you know, if he has to run for re-election with an unemployment rate that's almost certain to be over 8% and quite possibly over 9%, that's going to be really hard. That's not to say he's going to lose. He's a very effective politician, very, you know, charismatic speaker. You know, and the Republicans are going to raise a lot of questions. A lot of people are going to be scared by, you know, certainly if the Republican nominee is Rick Perry. So President Obama may still win in that context, but historically, it's been the case. People hold the party in power responsible, party who holds the White House responsible for the state of the economy.
So do you think that the president, he's going to lay out this jobs program, but I have a feeling that's going to fall flat because there's simply no way that he can ever implement it with the obstructionist Republicans. So what about him laying out the plan that you've just laid out? The end of loser liberalism, making markets progressive.
Yeah, well, I would love to see that. Unfortunately, I don't think it's terribly likely because he's got two things going on. One is he wants to get votes, but the other thing he's very conscious of is he has to get campaign contributions. They've set a target of raising over $1 billion for the reelection campaign, and you're not going to get that from, you know, going to Joe Working Stiff, Joe and Jane Working Stiff. So he wants to appease, you know, the business community, and for that he's trying very hard to be very business friendly. And the idea that he's really going to turn in some fundamental way and adopt policies that are designed to reverse the upward redistribution of the last three decades, I can't think of anything that will get the business community more angry. So I think that likely is a winning winning agenda with the public at large, but when you're going out raising campaign contributions, that's probably not the line you want to pitch.
So do you think, Dean Baker, that the president has been disadvantaged because of the weakness of his economic team? Not that too many people say good things about the people that led it, Larry Summers, etc., Tim Geithner, but he's lost Christine Romer, and now he's lost Austin Goolsbee, who never impressed me. In fact, Fox News has been playing an interview that Sean Hannity did with Goolsbee, you know, as a way to show how much Hannity could lacerate the liberal. You know, what do you think of this new guy that's filling the breach?
Well, Alan Krueger is a very smart guy in terms of, you know, who he might plausibly have picked. I mean, I could think of, you know, I'd love to see Joe Stiglitz there, you know, Nobel Prize-winning economist. Paul Krugman, another Nobel Prize-winning economist, columnist for the Times, of course, New York Times. I'd love to see those people there, but I knew that wasn't in the cards. So given the list of people who I thought he might pick, I think Alan Krueger is a good person, a smart guy, and relatively, you know, liberal, progressive. He's known, his first important work was showing that increases in the minimum wage do not lead to job loss. So, you know, in the scheme of things, I think it's a good pick. Now, does that mean we're going to see any big change in policy? No. I mean, I'd be shocked if, you know, I doubt Alan would push for anything that big. And even if he did, I don't think he's going to be able to overrule the political people. And for that matter, I think Timothy Geithner, the Treasury Secretary, carries probably more weight than anyone in economic policy right now. And Geithner, of course, is very close to Wall Street. So I consider him, in the scheme of things, a relatively good pick, but does it lead me to think anything's going to change? No, not at all.
Well, that's often the case, though, isn't it, that the chief economist in the White House takes a back seat to the Secretary of Treasury? At least that happened. You just mentioned Joe Stiglitz. He was effectively shut out during the Clinton administration by Robert Rubin, who was the Secretary of Treasury.
That's right, Stiglitz, and you also had Robert Reich arguing for a more progressive position. So both those, as Secretary of Labor, of course.
Right.
So it tends to be Secretary of Treasury tends to be the most important economic post, and you don't expect it's hard to envision someone coming in as head of the Council of Economic Advisers and really changing the course of an administration.
So just to broaden this landscape a little bit, from your new ebook, Dean Baker, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. When you talk about loser liberalism, there seems to be a kind of reflex on the American left to expect to lose. And you know, there's been a history of the liberals getting irritated and abandoning. They abandoned Humphrey in 68 and helped elect Nixon. They abandoned Carter for Teddy Kennedy in the primary, and then for John Anderson, another Republican, total phony as far as I could tell, in the general. That helped elect Reagan, and because Nader helped elect Bush in 2000, and so on. So there's a lack of strategy on the left, if that's the record. But how would you describe this phenomenon that seems to be where the left in this country would rather be righteous than effective, whereas the right don't care about intellectual inconsistencies? They're just determined to win.
Well, the right is playing hardball, and the left just hasn't been. Now, you know, the right comes with enormous advantages. I mean, you know, these are the rich people in the country. These are people that control the media to a very large extent. They control universities to a very large extent. I mean, they have enormous control, enormous power in ways that the left doesn't. But I think, you know, there literally is no effort on the left to have a coherent strategy. And, you know, one of the things I look back to, you go, you know, as much as I don't approve of what they were doing, it's hard not to admire how effective they were. So you go, okay, well, what did Reagan do when he came in office? Well, he saw the unions generally support Democrats, generally support progressive causes. Wipe them out. He didn't just win an election. He wanted to wipe them out. And to a large extent, private sector unions, when he came in office, they're 20% of the workforce. Today, they're about 7%. He looked at legal aid. Legal aid lawyers were going around defending poor people, filing class action suits against government, against corporations. He said, well, guess what? You can't do that anymore. Legal aid lawyers couldn't file class action suits. They could, you know, they could sue, you know, they could file suits someone, you know, who's having their security deposit held by a landlord wrongly, things like that. They couldn't do anything that might be seen as a political suit. He cut back funding for National Public Radio. He gave them a clear message. You're going to be more conservative or you're going to lose more funding. National Endowment of the Arts, same thing. So they're very systematic in looking at all the bases of support for progressive politics of any type and attack them. So it wasn't just a question of winning an election. They wanted to destroy any base of progressivism. And, you know, we couldn't do the same. It's not that we have the same levers of power that they do, but we're not even thinking in those terms. They were thinking, how do we make sure not that just President Reagan gets reelected in 1984, but we permanently change the terms of the debate, and they succeeded.
Well, Dean Baker, I thank you for joining us. And again, your new ebook, The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive, available at
www.cepr.net.
Well, I thank you again.
Thanks for having me on.
I've been speaking with Dean Baker, who is the co-director of the Center for Economic and Policy Research, a progressive economic think tank based in Washington, D.C. His books include Taking Economics Seriously, False Profits, Recovering from the Bubble Economy, and The Conservative Nanny State, How the Wealthy Use the Government to Stay Rich and Get Richer. He also writes the popular economics blog Beat the Press. His latest ebook is The End of Loser Liberalism, Making Markets Progressive. We're going to take a brief station break, and we'll be back talking about predictions that Europe is about to collapse.